From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung are the two most important people in the development of psychology and psychotherapy. Jung had been Freud's protege, but broke off from him in 1914. Two new books about Carl Jung call for a reevaluation of his life and work. On today's Fresh Air, we'll meet Frank McGlynn, author of a new biography of Jung, and Richard Knoll, author of a new book examining the controversial aspects of Jung's life, including his alleged anti-Semitism. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by Horace Tapscott. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Supporters of campaign finance reform say Majority Leader Trent Lott will not allow a test vote today on his proposed amendment targeting labor unions. Several moderate Republicans say they'll join Democrats in opposing the amendment. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Majority Leader Trent Lott apparently lacks the simple majority of votes needed to pass his amendment, so he's refusing to allow a vote to table it. Lott's amendment would prohibit unions from using dues for political purposes without prior consent. Knowing Democrats would oppose it, Lott intended to put Democrats in the position of filibustering the overall campaign finance bill. But the strategy seems to have backfired. Several Republicans have said they'd oppose Lott's amendment in the interest of keeping campaign finance reform alive. After two procedural votes today, Lott is likely to pull the bill from the floor. The bill's sponsors, Republican John McCain and Democrat Russell Feingold, say if that happens, they'll try to attach their reform measure to any and all legislation considered by the Senate. The first would be the Omnibus Transportation Bill. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News, the Capitol.
Texas authorities say a gunman angry with his girlfriend entered a San Antonio workplace today looking for her. When SWAT police entered the building a short time later, they found him dead along with two other women. Sandy Perez is a spokeswoman for the San Antonio Police Department.
About 10:15 this morning, SWAT did make entry into the building. When they went in, they found the suspect had shot himself. He had also shot and killed two female employees. Now, there was a third female employee who had initially come out at the beginning of this incident. She came out with a gunshot wound. She was airlifted to Brooke Army Medical Center, which is a local hospital here in San Antonio.
A fourth woman was unhurt. Substantive talks on Northern Ireland's political future have finally begun in Belfast, more than 3 years after they were first mooted and after a year of stop-go wrangling over the agenda. They began 3 weeks later than British Prime Minister Tony Blair called for them to start. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
For the first time in the troubled 75-year history of Northern Ireland, political leaders of the Catholic nationalist community and politicians from the Protestant unionist community are engaged in face-to-face negotiations. Not all unionist political parties eligible to be at the negotiating table took their seats. Ian Paisley's Democratic unionists and the smaller United Kingdom unionists are boycotting the talks. But the Ulster unionists, far and away the largest Protestant party, and several groups representing Protestant paramilitaries have decided to talk. Prime Minister Blair has set a deadline of next May for the politicians to agree on new political arrangements for the North. Michael Goldfarb, NPR News, London.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up nearly 53 points at 8,153. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher on the outlook for stable interest rates and decent corporate earnings. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The market's advance is being led by semiconductor stocks, which are higher following better-than-expected earnings from Motorola. The company is also expecting a modest increase in its computer chip business. And regional telephone shares have gained after USA Today reported that GTE is in merger talks with AT&T. Investors are also responding to bullish remarks from Abby Cohen, the co-chair of investment policy at Goldman Sachs. She believes the concerns which drove the market lower in August have abated, those being apprehension about Asian economic turbulence and possible U.S. inflation. The influential strategist is looking for the S&P 500 to gain 8% in the next year. I'm Doug Krisner.
The federal government will impose tighter fishing restrictions in an effort to bolster shrinking fish stocks. The National Marine Fisheries Service says 96 species sought by commercial and recreational fishermen are overfished or dangerously close to being overfished. The service says some species, like Pacific salmon, bluefin tuna, and American lobster, are so decimated they cannot reproduce enough to keep up with demand. As of today, the payphone industry is deregulated. That means the cost of making local phone calls on payphones could go up. Most payphones charge a quarter for a local call, and states that have experimented with deregulation say fees can jump to 35 cents. Providers are now free to charge as much as they wish to for local telephone calls. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two new books about psychiatrist Carl Jung call for a reevaluation of his life and work. Today we'll meet both authors. Early in his career, Jung was a protege of Freud. But Jung left the fold in 1914 when he began to embrace more mystical ideas. Jung developed the concepts of the extroverted and introverted personality types and individuation, the lifelong process in which a person achieves wholeness by integrating the conscious and unconscious self. Jung also originated the idea of the collective unconscious. Many of today's psychotherapists have based their approaches on his. He has also become a New Age icon. Frank McGlynn has written a new biography of Jung. He's also written biographies of poet Robert Louis Stevenson and explorer Sir Henry Morton Stanley. Richard Knoll is the author of The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung. It's Knoll's second book examining the controversial aspects of Jung's life, such as his alleged anti-Semitism, his mistreatment of female followers, and his ambition to create a cult group around him. Knoll is a lecturer in the history of science at Harvard. He writes in his book that he doubts an authentic, comprehensive account of Jung's life will be written anytime soon. To do so would require that the heirs of Jung's estate open up everything to a scholar. I asked Knoll and McGlynn if they each faced problems getting access to materials through the Jung estate. Richard Knoll answered first.
Yes. In a word, yes. The problem is, I think, twofold. Number one, the family and his close associates were aware of Jung's fascination with Aryan mysticism. And we now know, after Hitler and the Third Reich, that these things are associated with Nazis, when in fact most of these ideas predate National Socialism. Secondly, Jung lived polygamously for most of his life, openly so. Had a threesome relationship. The second wife in that relationship was a woman by the name of Toni Wolff, and he incorporated her into his daily schedule, his weekly schedule. His children had to put up with this fact. It was embarrassing to them. His children, I think, were largely siding with their mother most of their lives, not their father. And as a result, after he died, the last thing they wanted was more of this kind of information to be made public. It's quite understandable. They were essentially quite ashamed at times by their father and just outraged. He was a most unconventional fellow. So for these reasons, there has been very little cooperation from the Swiss.
I had the identical experience. In other words, a blanket refusal to cooperate in any shape or form, to an absurd point, because you'll notice that in my book there are no illustrations. The reason for that is that when I and my publishers approached the Jung Foundation to use their illustrative material, we were told we could only use images of Jung and his family on condition that the Jung Foundation had total editorial control, including the right of veto, over the script, over the text itself. Well, to me, that is total absurdity, but that's the situation, and that gives you an idea of the level of lack of cooperation.
Richard Knoll, you accuse Carl Jung of wanting to make himself into a god and to create a cult group around him. Give us a short explanation of what you mean.
Well, I'm not sure I would use the word accuse. I actually do base my conclusions on evidence. Jung had an experience in December of 1913, right after he broke off with Freud. The last letter that he exchanged with Freud was in January of 1913. Well, towards the end of 1913, Carl Jung decided to induce visionary experiences. He would go into a light trance and then imagine that he went into the underworld, and he would have various experiences with mythological entities. In one of these experiences in December 1913, Jung is confronted by a blind woman who calls herself Salome, and she walks up to him and says, "You are Christ." And Jung says, "Well, no, I'm not Christ." And she's very insistent. She says, "You are Christ." And at that moment, Jung describes it, he assumes the posture of the crucified Christ in a large boa constrictor, wraps itself around him, and his face and head transforms into that of a lion's head. Now, Jung, when he described this experience in a 1925 seminar, said that this was a deification experience. Literally, he felt that in the course of this experience, he had become a god. And the terminology here is a little... It's hard to pin down definitions exactly, especially when you're talking about mystical experiences. And subsequently, if you look at what Jung then does with his psychology, you notice some very interesting changes. You notice that by early 1914, he's claiming that patients are not having transferences based on personal emotional material, but that, in fact, they are having transferences that are guided somewhat by Platonic ideas or primordial images. Jung would call these archetypes. And later, as the First World War started and continued, as I found looking into patient diaries and letters and so on, Jung was actually training patients to have visions and to ultimately have the sort of experience he had, to become, each one of them, aware of their own Christ-like nature, their own God-like nature. And the recipe was that they had to become gods and then overcome this self-deification. And I bring this out because it shows how far Jung got from Freud in psychoanalysis in a very short period of time. And it also, I think, points to why the Jungian movement has the character it does today, which is essentially a purveyor of New Age spirituality and mysticism.
Frank McGlynn, how do you interpret this early experience of Jung's with mysticism?
Well, there's always been a school of thought that held that in 1913 Jung went mad and never came back. I mean, I think that's a hostile view, but it is a view that has been held. I didn't go quite that far, but I did treat that entire incident as a sort of psychotic interlude from which Jung more or less recovered. But I must say, the evidence that Richard has produced has certainly made me wonder about this and think again. I mean, in a sense, it makes the entire tangle of Jung's state of mind at that time even more complex. So where so many people have disagreed as to what Jung's state of mind was, and many analysts and others have offered diagnoses, it's very hard to come to a definite conclusion about all this. But all one can say for certain is that something very, very odd was going on.
No, when Jung says there that he felt a sense of his own deity, is that the words that you use?
Yes.
Well, I mean, that's in all kind of in the mystical aspects of all religion, God is embodied in every person and in everything. So, in some ways, there's really nothing particularly outrageous about a statement like that. And then, you know, when he says that he wanted to overcome that sense of his own deification, well, you don't want that sense of God and everything to mean that you have a big ego, you know, that you are the center of the universe.
Yeah, there is a coloring to this particular experience, especially the way Jung interprets it, that I think really needs to be addressed, and that's the historical and cultural context of this. When Jung became this god, it was an amalgam of an ancient Aryan god with Christ, and that's in part where the title of my book, The Aryan Christ, comes from. Jung at this time was very interested in Gnosticism, in Gnostic heresies. He was very interested in bringing back that sort of polytheistic flavor to things. Jung actually was quite hostile to Judeo-Christianity. And we can admire some of the ancient Gnostic ideas, this idea, you know, for example, that we all have a bit of the divinity within us and we just need to bring it out and God can have many faces and so on. You know, ideas that you find in other religions as well. The problem is that if you look at Jung within the context of his times and his beliefs during this period, he was surrounded primarily by Swiss who were German, and Germans, and a few Americans and Brits who had come to be in his inner circle, but not many. And in the context of these times, what Jung was doing was he was offering a path of initiation and transformation only for those who were biologically Aryan. This is a very important point here. In Jung's thinking, spirituality is rooted in biology. Now, as the years progressed, and certainly as after 1936, when Jung starts backpedaling from his support of the Third Reich, he doesn't talk like this quite as much. But if you really get into the way Jung thought during this period, many of the ideas are things that we now associate with National Socialism. It's quite a shock to many Jungians today to realize this. But spirituality is rooted in biology. You have to remember that when you think about Jung during this period.
My guests are Richard Knoll and Frank McGlynn. They've each written new books about Carl Jung. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Frank McGlynn, author of a new biography of Carl Jung, and Richard Knoll, author of The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung. When we left off, we were talking about Jung's Aryan mysticism. Frank McGlynn, do you agree with this assessment that the kind of teaching that he was doing, the kind of enlightenment he was looking for, was something he felt was only available to Aryans?
Well, there's no question about Jung's being racist, if we judge him by contemporary standards. If you think of the work he did on what he called, the Indian influences and the Negro influences, as the terms then were used, in the United States. I mean, Jung believed in the influence of the earth. He believed in the influence of race permeating the earth. He said that white people who went to the Americas acquired characteristics of the red man, and then later when they brought in black slaves, they acquired those characteristics. So even if you read works of Jung's, which are readily available in the collected works, they're not esoteric ones such as the ones that Richard has dug at, you can see quite clearly that there is a kind of quasi National Socialist blood and earth approach to questions of race, and Jung is quite upfront about it.
Yeah, well, that whole concept actually is really at the center of a lot of much of the way Jung viewed the world. There's that concept was also associated with the old blood and soil, you know, Blut und Boden philosophy of Aryanism. It was this idea that the landscape formed your soul, and it formed the souls of your ancestors. Your ancestors lived on the land, they died on the land, their blood was in the soil. And that there was actually something like energy that came out of the soil and of the landscape that would shape your soul and even shape your the way you looked, you know, one generation from the next. And that's why, for example, Jung and many in his day and the culture, historians have this term now, we get around the word racist and we call it racialist. What Jung believed was that the Aryans were privileged and they were forced to become Christians. Christianity was this alien Jewish religion. It was monotheistic, monogamous, and it was forced on the Aryan tribes of northern Europe in around 1000 AD. and that this way of thinking was alien to the Aryans. Biologically, they were polytheistic. They worshipped the sun. They were nudists. They worshipped in sacred groves. Whereas the culture that was imposing this religion, Jews primarily, Jung saw Christianity as essentially a Jewish religion, as did many in his day. These were people that had wandered the earth. They came from a land that was dry and desolate, that was barren. And you have to understand that this, Jung thought that this shaped their soul, that there was something about Jews in particular that made them disconnected from nature. And as Jung thought during the First World War and even afterwards, this made them bad candidates for his brand of therapy because they were practically unredeemable. You couldn't get them to the point where they could reconnect with their natural spirituality.
Frank LeGuin, do you want to contradict anything that Richard Noel has just said?
No, that seems perfectly in line with everything I discovered. Certainly he had this view that, as you know, one of the elements in anti-Semitism, certainly before the State of Israel, was that you can't trust Jews because they have no national allegiance. You know, they're a wandering tribe ever since the diaspora. Well, Jung put a sort of slightly different spin on that in the way that Richard has just described by saying that there is something in the very nature of a nomadic people that affects their spirituality and their attitude to theism and to God. So it goes much deeper than that.
Well, Frank McGlynn, in your biography of Jung, you bring out some, I think, very interesting points that Jung had made that made him uncomfortable with Christianity the way it was being practiced. Why don't you go into some of those points for us?
Yes, well, I think there are two that really stand out. One is the idea that in the Christian tradition, the problem of evil is wrongly considered, because evil is considered as something apart. There is good on one side and there's evil on the other. It's the old Manichaean dualism. And traditional Christian theology, there was God and the angels. On the other side, there was Satan and the demons. Now, Jung was insistent that good and evil are part of the same reality, that they interpenetrate. And therefore, to give a correct description of evil, you have to consider it as being, in some sense, an aspect of what is usually considered good. Therefore, you're in the realm of ambiguity and ambivalence all the time. You're not in the realm of straight good and straight evil. And Jung suggested that the correct way to look at the Godhead was not via the traditional Christian Trinity, but in terms of a quaternity, which would have Satan and the devil, if you like, as the fourth part of the Godhead. So that was one of the ways in which he particularly acted as a gadfly to traditional Christian believers. The other was his insistence that God was not something out there, but something within. God was not a transcendental being. The only meaning for God or the numinous is what is within you. And he always argued that this was the true meaning of St. Paul, but that this had been perverted by mistranslation. So Jung was always insistent that there was no God out there. The only God was inside people. But critics of Jung fastened on this and said, well, Jung changed his mind about things like ghosts. Jung began by thinking that ghosts were simply, in some sense, externalized complexes of human mind. But later on in life, he began to think that ghosts really were out there. So the Christian critics said, well, if ghosts can be really out there, what's the objection to a transcendental God out there? And Jung never answered that one satisfactorily.
So with the idea of good and evil, Jung felt that we should like own up to the aspects of good and evil within ourselves and understand those parts both as being parts of our personality instead of kind of completely separating good and evil, God and the devil. Is that?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I suppose a very good example of this comes in the Robert Louis Stevenson story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, where Stevenson makes it quite plain that the reason Dr. Jekyll goes off the rails and becomes mad is that he tries to decant all the evil in himself into a separate personality called Mr. Hyde. And if you try to do that, you will go mad. And Jung was saying something similar. He was saying that you have to accept that so-called good and evil are different aspects of one reality, and they're not separate forces. God or Christ and or Jesus and the forces of light on one side and Satan on the forces of darkness on the other. Mm. That's a sort of a neurotic way of looking at reality. And the correct way is to see them as being fused and interpenetrated.
What we're getting at here with these concepts of good and evil, as Jung treats them, I think gets at the heart of several things. First of all is his notion of individuation and what an individuated person is. It's one of these ideas that attracts a great many people. It certainly attracts many Christians that I know. They think this is just a fine concept. They interpret it as Jung saying, well, you know, you should work on your soul to be a better person. And
I think you need to just describe what individuation is, what it means.
Aha, uh-huh, yeah, well, yeah, okay. Well, individuation is essentially the process of becoming an individual, becoming a unique person, unlike anyone who's ever existed. Now, however, at the same time, Jung says there's this paradoxical thing where you're actually becoming connected, more connected with the human race. But the interpretation of this usually by people is that it means you work on your soul to become a better person. But if you really read Jung carefully, you know, what is an individuated person? You know, this ideal human that he's proposing. Well, it's someone who is amoral, someone who is, in the Nietzschean sense, beyond good and evil. It's someone who can be capable of the greatest good and the greatest evil. It's not a Christian. Jung is not saying, you know, love thy neighbor as thyself. You know, he's not saying turn the other cheek. He's essentially, in many respects, saying, you know, get to the point where you can adapt to society and to the world, but at the same time live instinctually, creatively, like our early human ancestors did.
Richard Knoll is the author of The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung. Frank McGlynn is the author of a new biography of Jung. They'll be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with the authors of two books about Carl Jung, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by Horace Tapscott.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the authors of two new books about Carl Jung, one of the most important figures in the development of psychotherapy. Frank McGlynn is the author of a new biography of Jung. Richard Knoll is the author of The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung. Let's look at a question that, Richard Knoll, you particularly raise in your book, The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung. You say that Carl Jung was anti-Semitic, that he briefly had ties to the Nazis. I want you to encapsulate some of that for us.
Sure. This is one of the most painful issues, really. It was for me personally in doing research on Jung and discovering what his beliefs truly were and what some of his actions were. And certainly it's been painful to generations of people of all persuasions, Freudian and Jungian. But essentially, after he broke with Freud, it was fairly clear that Jung was conscious, at least, of anti-Semitic feelings in himself. How do we know this? Well, he wrote a confidential letter to an Aryan colleague of his in late 1913. This is a Swedish psychoanalyst. And he says, well, you know, up to now, I haven't been an anti-Semite, but I think I'm going to become one, I believe. And Jung is on record repeatedly for making statements like that, which is unfortunate. His own disciples had a difficult time trying to integrate that. Even his Jewish disciples, there was one in particular, a woman by the name of Yolanda Jacobi, who was with Jung from the 1930s until his death. And he would say things to her like, well, you know, I wouldn't want to have a child, that had Jewish blood in it. And he would tell others, well, you know, this is during 1933 and 34. He would say things like, well, you know, the Jews, they should wear different clothing than the rest of us, so we know who they are, so they don't take advantage of us. Things like this, which point to a level of anti-Semitic feeling in him. Now, how did he act on it? You know, it's hard to say exactly. Was he a Nazi? No, he was not a Nazi. Was he a Nazi sympathizer? I would argue in this book, yes, for the first 3 years of Hitler's regime, Jung was a Nazi sympathizer. And again, I think he got caught up in it, as many people did at that time, not for the political stuff that was happening, not necessarily for the anti-Semitism, but because so many people were hungry for a spiritual rebirth. There were many, many people for many decades before Hitler came to power who wanted to get rid of Christianity the way it was and to replace it with something that was more congruent with German Aryan spirituality. And in fact, when Hitler came to power, there was a great neo-pagan movement. And they even called themselves that at that time. And one of the leaders was a fellow by the name of Hauer that Jung gave seminars with. Jung, after Hitler came to power, suddenly became famous for the first time in Germany. For many years, he was ignored by German professors and universities, and then suddenly in 1933, he's getting all sorts of invitations to come and give seminars. Now, I think all of these things kind of went to his head. And then something happened in 1936, and we're not sure exactly what, but Jung starts backing off. And it's at this point that Jung really starts emphasizing that he's Swiss and not German. Prior to this time, again, Jung is 60 years old in 1936. Prior to this time, the statements about him being Swiss, Jung just brushes off. He considered himself German. His father's ancestors were all from Germany, German in the tribal sense. He writes letters with statements like, you know, wir Germanen, you know, we Germans, and suddenly becomes Swiss in 1936, which is quite interesting.
Frank McGlynn, do you think that Richard Knoll is overstating the case at all?
No, I don't think so. No, I think the case is very nuanced. He doesn't say that Jung continued to be a virulent... he doesn't even say he was a Nazi. He doesn't continue to be a virulent supporter of National Socialism after 1936. I think there were several reasons why Jung was predisposed in favour of the Hitler movement. One of them was that he had this strange notion that Germany had never been fully Christianized and that the longing in the German unconscious was for the old Germanic war god Wotan. And he said Wotan lurks in the Germanic unconscious. And when Hitler came to power, he took this as a triumphal vindication of his theory, and he said to it, there you are, I told you so. I told you Votan was in the unconscious. Here he comes now in the shape of Hitler. Now people will see that I'm right. And I think for the first 3 years, he was so taken up with the triumphalism of his own theory that he forgot what he was actually dealing with. That was part of it.
Frank McGlynn, in your biography of Jung, you bring up a very interesting paradox in the relationship between Freud and Jung. You say that one of the reasons why Freud was so pleased to have Jung as one of his disciples was that he felt that Jung would ensure that psychology didn't become a victim of anti-Semitism, that psychology wouldn't be shot down just because Freud was Jewish.
Yes, indeed. In religious terms, it was the case of taking the gospel to the Gentiles, as St. Paul had done. That was the importance of Jung for Freud, that if Jung and other Aryans took up the theory, then people couldn't say, well, it's just another crazy Jewish cult or sect that we can disregard and marginalise. It must be of much more universal significance because it's not confined to Jews. So Jung was crucially important to Freud from that point of view.
But then Jung, you write, threatened to undo Freud's work by producing a Christianized version of psychology.
Yes, well, of course, the paradox was that Jung turned out to be precisely the person who posed the greatest danger to psychoanalysis of making it a ghettoized Jewish theory, because he tried to take over the leadership of depth psychology and marginalize Freudianism as a kind of heretical sect. You know, for a while it was a bit like the struggle in the early church between the Arians and the Athanasians. You know, which one is going to be the heresy and which one is going to be the orthodoxy?
You say that Freud was eventually afraid that Jung would destroy psychology, whereas Jung later accused Freud of being the devil.
Yes, well, of course, this is part of the anti-Semitism in Jung, was that so often in his mind he had this equation Freud equals Jew, and by the same token, Jew equals Freud. So I definitely think that on many occasions when he's talking about Jews and the Jew, as he does, he's really thinking about his old enemy, Freud.
Jung started out in psychology as Freud's disciple, really, and then went off and they had a very serious split and went off in two very different directions. What were the things that Jung first really was attracted to about Freud's theories of psychology? And I'll let whoever wants to talk first take this one.
Yeah. You see, Jung tells us in his autobiography, and I don't think there's any particular need to doubt this part of his testimony, that he always thought of himself as being two people. There was what he called the number one personality and the number two personality. And the number one personality was basically a scientific rationalist, and the number two personality was some kind of mystic. Now, Jung says that he went into medicine and then into psychiatry so that the scientific and the rationalist side of him would predominate. But if you read the interesting material that Richard Knowles unearthed on Jung's dabbling in spiritualism, you can see that he quite clearly felt a powerful need to do this, possibly to save himself from going mad. And he did always fear hereditary madness. Okay, right. Well, he then goes into his early hospital work in Zurich, and tries to make himself a scientist. Now, I think the really important thing about Freud for Jung was that here was a man who enabled him to make sense of both aspects of his life. Psychoanalysis provided a means whereby the science of psychology could be dovetailed with his interest in the occult and his interest in spiritualism, and it proved to him in a sense that he was a whole person. He wasn't a fragmented, split person. Psychoanalysis was the key to that, and Freud was the head of this movement. So even before he'd met Freud and made personal contact, there was a powerful thrust in that direction.
If you're just joining us, both my guests have written books about psychologist Carl Jung. Frank McGlynn is joining us from London. He's the author of Carl Gustav Jung, a biography. Richard Knoll is joining us from Boston. He's the author of The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung. Why don't we take a short break and then talk some more? This is Fresh Air. back with the authors of two books about Carl Jung. Richard Knoll is the author of The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung. He's joining us from Boston. Frank McGlynn is the author of Carl Gustav Jung, A Biography, and he's joining us from England. One of the theories that Carl Jung is most known for is an idea called the collective unconscious. Would one of you like to explain what that is?
Well, I think I'll let Richard do this one.
Thanks a lot. Well, Jung proposes this idea in 1916. And essentially, Jung proposes that there are certain experiences that human beings can have in dreams or in fantasies or in psychotic symptoms that come from material memories that are not personal, but in fact are transpersonal or collective in a sense. Jung thought that literally fragments of experiences that our ancestors had were still in our biological fiber and could be reached under certain conditions. What is this material? And this is where Jung really takes off. It's primarily mythic and religious. Jung had spent, as I said, 9 years as an experimental psychiatrist studying human memory. He studied things like unconscious plagiarism, you know, when somebody would write something and then unconsciously work in material from something that they had previously read. Jung's case history of his spiritualist medium cousin was essentially a way of debunking all of her claims. She claimed she was talking to ancestors and there was reincarnation memories and so on. And Jung was able to show early in his career that no, all of this material that was coming up was actually from previous experiences she had had, things she had read, and so on. What is so interesting is that in 1916, Jung suddenly forgets all of this research he had done, showing again and again how human memory distorts things, how it constructs things. And after 1916, Jung really wasn't very interested in trying to knock down or actually get rid of alternate explanations for the collective unconscious. Whenever a patient would come to him with a dream that had something vaguely mythological in it, Jung would insist that it was from this deeper, archaic, transpersonal level, which had actually no basis in science. Now, okay, fine, so Jung made a logical error here. You know, he'd had some mystical experiences, which to him were convincing proof of this collective unconscious. And I think that's why he tended to bend evidence throughout his life, to make evidence that he was seeing in his consulting room fit. Now, the darker aspect of this and the most troubling aspect is there are many, many instances which you can actually prove very easily just by analyzing Jung's case histories, his published case histories, where Jung lies about his evidence. The crux of the argument is that usually in a case history, Jung will say, well, this patient came to me. She had no previous experience with alchemy, and yet she had this series of dreams with these remarkable alchemical images with, you know, myths and gods and so on. And you go back and you do the historical research and find out who these people were, and they were all patients who came to Jung for treatment, generally after they had been through things like theosophy, spiritualism. They knew about alchemy. They were basically into stuff that was very popular today, even in New Age circles.
So you're saying they knew the images, and it probably wasn't from the collective unconscious.
Right.
Frank McGlynn, how much credence does the collective unconscious now have in psychological circles or sociological circles? Yeah, go ahead.
I think it has a lot of credence in certain Jungian circles. I don't think it has much outside that. It is, I think it is actually a very old idea. I mean, if you go back to Plato in the Timaeus, he talks about the world soul, the idea that there is a kind of collective soul that it informs the entire universe. And Jung was quite keen on Plato, and I think that was one of the influences in his theory of the collective unconscious.
Don't you think the collective unconscious was also meant to speak to certain things that humans seem to share around the world and through the centuries, such as beliefs in God, beliefs in some kind of spiritual thing? That why is it that throughout recorded history there have been religions? And wouldn't he use the collective unconscious to explain that?
Sure, but you can turn that back on itself, can't you? You can say, well, of course, all human beings have similar myths because they all have similar experience. We're all born, we all die, you know, we reproduce, we have similar encounters with forces of nature, large waves, sharks or something. This is common throughout the world. Of course, the myths are going to reflect that common experience. And you even get people like Heyerdahl trying to claim that the myth started in one place and was then diffused over the world. I mean, these ideas aren't necessary. You don't need a theory of the collective unconscious to explain why human myths are similar. It seems to me an unnecessary hypothesis.
Frank McGlynn, you write that the most problematic aspects of Jung's biography are have to do with his turbulent married life. What gave you trouble there?
Well, simply that, as Richard said earlier, you can't find out the details of who all these people were. I mean, we know that he was promiscuous and had a kind of an informal harem, but we can't get at the names, and that is presumably some of the information that's being held onto like grim death by the Jung Foundation.
Do you have any evidence that he was unfair to or mistreated women who he was with?
Oh, I think he was extremely brutal. That comes out in the affair with Sabina Spielrein, which is now pretty well documented, which people know about quite well. And however you read that, even if you give him the benefit of every doubt and say, you know, even if you say at the limit, this is a neurotic woman talking, it doesn't really work. I mean, he behaved extremely badly. And we know from the famous letter that he wrote to Sabina Spielrein's mother, saying that nobody should be able to criticise him because he was a doctor, and if they wanted to criticise him, they should be paying him extra fees. That, I mean, his attitude was absolutely out of order, as we say.
When you say brutal, did he hit her,
yes,
the physical brutality?
Oh, I'm sure he did, because we know for a fact that he threw, I think, I can't remember who it was now, it may have been Yolanda J. He threw, certainly threw one of his women supporters down a flight of stairs.
Right.
So he didn't draw the line at physical violence.
Frank McGlynn, you write that you think it's ironic that Jung has been seen as pro-woman as opposed to the allegedly anti-woman positions of Freud. Would you elaborate on that?
Yes, well, as you probably know, in the early days of the feminist movement, Freud was a major target until Juliette Mitchell restored the balance with her book, showing how you could, in fact, integrate feminism and psychoanalysis in a much more constructive way. And I think that approach is right and true. But it seems to me that there's been an awful lot of what I can only describe as propaganda about Jung from people who say things like, Jung made me understand what it was like to be a woman. He made me understand my femininity clearly. And all I'm saying is as a would-be conscientious biographer, I can't see this, because it seems to me that what Jung actually says about women is not all that complimentary and not all that flattering.
I guess the question I really want to ask you both is, do you think there's anything worth keeping about Carl Jung's philosophy? I mean, so far, everything that we've talked about has to do with the more questionable parts of his life or his teachings. What do you think is worth keeping about Jungian philosophy? Jungian psychoanalysis, I should say. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
well, go ahead. Hang yourself, Frank. Yeah.
Well, my case is that the Jung's most valuable work took place in three main areas, but most of them are a long way away from the areas where he thought he did his most valuable work. I think the three areas are the early work on schizophrenia in his pre-Freudian period, his what I think is very talented work as a theologian in his book on Job, and the quite courageous probing into certain areas of the so-called supernatural in his late life. If you ask me to say what are the most valuable parts of Jungian thought, those are the ones I'd go for. Unfortunately, from Jung's point of view, those would probably be considered peripheral. The central tenets I'm not so impressed by.
Richard Noll, what about you?
Well, I would agree with everything that Frank just said, and just add that for me personally, you know, again, as someone who is not a Jung basher, what I find valuable in Jung's work is his emphasis on this idea that that we must come to terms with the spiritual in life, however defined, and that spirituality is part of a mentally healthy life, and also this idea that I like Jung as a phenomenologist of human experience. I like the fact that he realized that we are multiple selves. Jung ties that in with his whole polytheistic, pagan worldview. But essentially, that's a very valuable metaphor and in a very valuable tool in clinical work. At least I found this idea that we are multiple selves.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us about Jung. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Richard Knoll is the author of The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung. Frank McGlynn is the author of a new biography of Carl Jung. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by pianist Horace Tapscott. This is Fresh Air. Pianist Horace Tapscott was born in Houston in 1934 and was raised on blues and gospel music. He spent a little time in New York in the late 50s. Aside from that, he spent almost all his life in Los Angeles. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Tapscott has been a sort of guardian angel in the City of Angels. He's also a very good piano player. Kevin reviews a new Tapscott Trio CD.
Horace Tapscott playing Willetta's Walk. Typical of Horace Tapscott. That tune doesn't call attention to its own cleverness. You could easily not notice it's in 5/4 time, if that means anything to you. After 30 years of not being so well known, even in jazz circles, Tapscott is now getting recognized for not doing what jazz musicians are supposed to do to get noticed. He didn't settle in New York to face off against his opposition. He chose for Los Angeles, where he's involved himself in less competitive activities. Since the 60s, his big band, the Pan-African People's Orchestra, has been a nurturing ground for players and composers from the city's black community. Tapscott is a genial idealist with the presence of a Lincoln. At way over 6 feet tall, with octopus limbs, he just about dwarfs the piano. With a sustain pedal down, hammering out dense chords, he can get a sound as big as he is, but that big sound can cloud over. As pianist, he sounds best accompanied by a crisp rhythm section. On his new CD called Thoughts of Dar es Salaam, that would be Ray Drummond on bass and Billy Hart on drums. Horace Tapscott playing his Thoughts of Dar es Salaam. In the 1960s, that sort of material, a bass vamp like a trotting camel, solos built from simple scales, became a sort of metaphor for the connection between jazz and African roots. True, it doesn't sound much like real African music, like Ellington's so-called jungle music of the 20s, as far as that goes, but accuracy isn't the point. It relates more to a kind of stubborn ethnic pride that bloomed in cities like Los Angeles in the 60s and 70s. Such music identifies more with the romance of the Sahara than the epic tragedies of the slave coast. Horace Tapscott has a lot of tunes like that. But on his new CD, he also plays some old bebop numbers, like Social Call, a nice line by saxophonist Gigi Grice. There's a central paradox about jazz's out-of-town legends. If Horace Tapscott had stayed in New York all those years ago, he would have attracted attention sooner, but he might not have developed into the Horace Tapscott whose music and community activism help shape one another. As a sign of how much he gets back from the musicians he works with in L.A., he'll record some of their tunes alongside his. Every jazz scene exerts subtle pressure on musicians to adopt the local accent, to conform to a prevailing style or a way of phrasing, or just a common way of hearing where the beat is. Resisting New York is one way to hold on to the independent perspective a good jazz musician needs. But teaming up the Angelino with a regulation New York rhythm section was a good idea, too. It keeps the big man on his toes.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Thoughts of Dar es Salaam by Horace Tapscott and his trio on the Arabesque label. Fresh Air was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Johnson White House tapes. The secret recordings LBJ made of his conversations during his presidency have been released. We'll talk with historian Michael Beschloss, who has edited and analyzed the first volume of transcripts. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.